The cloud. Welcome to the Sunday night There Is a Solution newcomer and returning members meeting of Overeaters Anonymous. Visit our website at oaontario.org, where you'll find this audio recording, additional podcasts, and a place to donate to keep this special service active. The opinions expressed are those of individual OA members and do not represent OA as a whole. We'll now introduce Janet. Janet B., a member who she has at least 6 months, she has many more than 6 months of abstinence. She's recovered through the directions in the Big Book, and she maintains recovery on a daily basis. After she shares and tells her story, about half an hour, there'll be time for everybody to, those who wish to make a comment or ask a question about the OA program or what Janet has shared. So please help me welcome Janet, a compulsive, recovered compulsive overeater from New Jersey. Did I get that right, Janet?
You got it. You got it. Thank you. Thank you. Thanks, Pat. Thanks, Jessica, for inviting me. Thanks, Canada, where it's cold, even colder than it is here. So I'm Janet, recovered from compulsive eating and bulimia. Some of you mentioned you heard me share this morning on vision. I shared on God's search and rescue mission for Dr. Bob. And so now I'd like to tell you a little bit about God's search and rescue mission for me. I was a total train wreck. I stole food. I stole money for food. I was bulimic. When I first went, I went to my first OA meeting, I was 15 years old, and I already knew there was something different about me. And I felt happy walking into an OA meeting, like, this is great. There's other people like me. But I didn't get better. So I felt great knowing there was a fellowship, but I didn't get better. It would be like if I were a diabetic and thought I was the only diabetic on the planet and went to Diabetics Anonymous meeting and met all these other diabetics, that would be really cool. But if I wasn't injecting the insulin, I wouldn't get one bit better. And that was me. I went from binging and purging. I would make myself throw up maybe twice a week. After 6 or 7 years in OA, I was doing it up to 6 times a day. I actually had to have the valve on my esophagus surgically retightened because of the damage I had done. I was not a very nice person. I was a compulsive liar. I would make up crazy stories, like when I was in college, my boyfriend wasn't paying enough attention to me. So I did what any normal addict college girl would do. I took a razor, slashed myself up, told him I was mugged and raped, and had him take me to the hospital where I swallowed the penicillin so I wouldn't get syphilis from my fake rapist. Went through a fake rape exam, all to get attention. Didn't care that my boyfriend was in an Ivy League college in a rigorous program of study. All I cared about was getting what I want. But of course, right? Selfishness is the root of this illness. I did pretty much what I was told for those 6 or 7 years. I had about 50 different sponsors. I'm not exaggerating. And, you know, people would tell me to write down, abstinence is the most important thing in my life without exception. So I would write it and I would just do what I was told. But the problem was, for about the first 7 years, I wasn't told the right thing. It would be like, again, let's say I'm a diabetic and I go to Diabetics Anonymous and my DA sponsor says, take penicillin. And I take penicillin because that seems like it'll help, but it wouldn't help. It didn't help. And I thought I binged because I was miserable. And then I remember one day I was in OA, I think a senior in high school, and this college boy invited me to a concert, Beach Boys concert, and I was in heaven and I binged. And I was so puzzled. And then I thought, I must be binging to sabotage my happiness. And I've learned since that that's not true. I don't binge because I'm miserable. I don't binge because I want to sabotage everything. I binged because I had an illness and I couldn't not binge. And the way I understand it now is like, a bridge, that normally there's a bridge between my conscious mind and my memory. So stored in my memory are obviously things that have happened. So for instance, I have a terrible cat allergy. If I go near cats, I'm liable to have an asthma attack. So stored in my memory are all these data points of cat-induced asthma attacks. So if someone, my sponsee Melissa's here on this line, she's got a cat. If she invited me to her house and I was tempted to say yes, immediately my memory would grab those data points from my memory that says, danger, cats will give you an asthma attack, don't go. Send a thought across the bridge to my conscious mind where I make decisions. And I tell Melissa, I'm sorry, but unless you get rid of your cat, I'm not able to go to your house. Or the big book talks about hot stoves, right? So stored, it talks about, you know, we don't have the mechanism that prevents us from putting our hand on a hot stove. Well, why don't we put our hand on a hot stove? Well, again, stored in my memory are all these data points of, I went to touch a hot stove and I burnt my hand. So I'm about to clean up after dinner, but I've cooked on the stove. Immediately, my memory grabs the data points. It says, danger, hot stoves, they'll burn you. Generates a thought to run across the bridge to my conscious mind to say, stop, danger, you'll burn your hand. And so I don't clean the stove. I mean, I clean it later, but I don't clean it while it's hot. So let's talk about food. In college, I used to binge on I binge on a lot of things, but I binged a lot on this certain kind of cookie. It would come in a box of 20 and I would tell myself, I'm just going to have one or two. So of course, stored in my brain and my memory are all these data points of me telling myself I'm just going to have one or two and then eating the whole box. So there I go again, about to go to the store, buy a box of cookies to have just one or two. And my memory does its job. It searches through the data, grabs the data points to generate a little thought to run across the bridge to say, stop, danger. You're not going to be able to stop at one or two. You're going to eat the whole box. You're going to hate yourself. You're going to gain weight. Don't do it. Except, unlike with hot stoves and cats, when it came to food, the bridge was broken. There was no connection between my memory and my conscious mind. So my memory failed to hold me in check. That's what they talk about on page 24, that paragraph's in italics. And it says, there comes a point in the life of every abnormal drinker, or for us eater, where the most powerful desire to stop eating is of absolutely no avail. So I had the desire, I didn't have the power, because there was a disconnect between my memory and my conscious mind. I couldn't remember with enough impact to stop me how horrible the binging was. And I was hopeless, right? Bill Wilson says on page 8, you know, alcohol was my master. Quicksand stretched around me, right? Quicksand, the harder you struggle, the more you just fall in. And food was my master. And there I was, even in OA, going to OA alone did not do it, right? Just like going to Diabetics Anonymous, if we're not injecting the insulin, we'll do nothing. So there I was, miserable, you know, trying, my bulimia getting worse, me listening, getting dropped by sponsor after sponsor, because I wasn't getting better. And again, they said, oh, she just doesn't want to stop. I wanted to stop more than anything. I didn't have the power to stop. So there I was about 8 years in. It was, I think, I can't remember the exact date. I think it was sometime in April. I was at an OA convention and I was eating compulsively at the convention. But I saw these two women walking around and they were thin, and I was never really overweight. I was about 20 something pounds heavier than I am now, but that's because I was throwing up 5 or 6 times a day. So you can imagine how much food I must have been eating to, you know, still have 20 or more extra pounds on me and throwing up that much. So I'm at the OA convention And I sit down and I see one of those young women. I was 23 years old at the time. See one of these young women standing up with a big book in her hand. And she said she hadn't binged in a year. Well, to me, a year was like an eternity. I mean, you know, I couldn't get 30 days in those 6 or 7 years. I never got 30 days together. Sometimes I couldn't make it to lunch. You know, I just couldn't do it. I couldn't stay on a food plan. I would commit my food plan. I would have my food and I couldn't do it. And so she said a year, and I couldn't fathom that. So I wanted to go up to her. Little did I know that she was a major part of God's search and rescue program for me. I wanted to go up to her, but I was scared. It would be like, you don't approach an angel. But the girl who had been with her just happened to be sitting next to me. So I said, "Do you know her?" And she said, "She's my sister. Come on, I'll introduce you." So that's when I met Donna. And we talked, and I told her how I couldn't stop. And she told me to read the first 164 pages of the big book, the text section of the big book. And, you know, we'd talk afterwards. I skipped the talent show of the convention that night. I was up in my hotel room and I just read those 164 pages because I wanted to get better. And the next day I went down and I saw her, and she said, "Are you willing to do everything, you know, that it says?" And I said, "Well, there's this one amend." Remember that boyfriend who I did that whole rape scam? Well, there was more to that scam. Afterwards, I told him I was pregnant and I didn't know if the baby was his or the rapist. And I took money for a fake abortion. So I wasn't really keen on going back to this guy and telling him that I'd made the whole thing up. So she said, "Are you willing to believe that by the time you get to your ninth step, you'll be a different person?" And I said, "Okay," right? What else could I say? I was desperate and I was hopeless. So she lived an hour and a half from me. And shortly after, I lived in New York City at the time. She lived two states away. I took the train up to a meeting. I had a couple false starts. And there was the first meeting I went to there, it was like this. I think it's great that you have Q&A after, because, you know, newcomers need it. So there I was. I mean, but I wasn't a newcomer. I'd been in 6.5 years, but I raised my hand and I said, "I've been in the program for 6.5 years and I still can't stop binging." And this old timer said to me, "You may have been going to meetings for 6.5 years, but you have not been in the program." And I'm like, okay. And I just felt here was a whole bunch of people who hadn't binged in a long time, like not just Donna, there's like a whole group of them. So I started hanging out there and, you know, I got abstinent for a while and then I picked up again. And then one day I had been stuffing bagel chips down my throat behind a locked bathroom door before a meeting up there, an hour and a half train ride away. And I spoke at the meeting. And afterwards, I went up to the toughest person there, the one who had given me that feedback. And I said, "Will you sponsor me?" And it was like, "What are you willing to do?" And I remember thinking, I hope I'm not told I have to like move two states away, because if that's what I'm told to do, I'm going to have to do it. But I wasn't told that. But my sponsor was really strict with me and told me later that God, an inspiration, make it difficult for her, because we value what we have to work hard for, right? Who values the car more? The teenager whose parents hand it to them on their 16th birthday, or someone like, you know, a kid who like has a paper route and works hard and saves up? Well, I had to be like that kid with the paper route who worked hard to save up. So I was willing to go to any lengths. And I've since learned that that's critical, right? Because on page 58, it says, if you have decided you want what we have, what do we have? A spiritual experience based on these steps. And a spiritual experience is defined in the second appendix as a personality change sufficient to overcome alcoholism or compulsive eating. Basically, I do this work and God comes in and rewires my heart in such a way that the obsession with food is kicked to the curb. So I was willing. And I left that meeting and I said a prayer. I said, God, I've always had fixed ideas of what you were like and how to worship you. I'm willing to admit it's all wrong and to start over and let you show me what you're like and how to worship you. And for me, it was like a hand just reached into my soul and yanked out the obsession. But I don't think it was just because of that prayer. I think it was because I also committed to doing what I could. Now, sometimes people say, well, I don't know what God wants. But there are certain things we do know what God wants. We know God wants us to be honest. And I believe if we're not honest, it's like we took a big black magic marker and wrote the words, keep out God, right across our hearts. God absolutely won't coexist with dishonesty. So I was told by my sponsor, if I wasn't honest, I would get dropped instantly. So I became rigorously honest. And I was, you know, just a crazy liar before. So I would be in the middle of a conversation and I would say something and I'd say, wait a second, what I just said, that was dishonest. I would stop myself. I was very intentional about being honest. So it wasn't like, yeah, I think I was honest. I was on my toes until it got to the point where God just removed the dishonesty, where now, I kid you not, if I were to be dishonest, I would feel sick to my stomach. I can't be dishonest now. When my kids were teenagers and they'd say, Mom, did you look at my cell phone? They would know that if I did, I would have to confess. They just knew. Like my son, when he was 16 or so, I overheard him say to his girlfriend, my mom's a lot of things, but she's not a liar. From a 16-year-old, I'll take it. So I became honest. I started doing things for other people. And I worked the steps. So I had taken a first step, right? I knew I had a broken bridge, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. You know, on page 55, my favorite line in the book, it says, deep down in every man, woman, and child is the fundamental idea of God. It may be obscured by calamity, by pomp, by worship of other things, but in some form or other, it is there. I love that. Deep down in all of us is the idea of God. So that says to me, when God created us, right? He gave us like two lungs, two kidneys, a heart, and somewhere in there, he planted the fundamental idea of himself. Because he loves me. He loves us so much. He just put that right there. And it says it can be obscured. Like calamity, right? Bad things that have happened. That was a problem for Bill Wilson. He said, you know, the wars, the chicanery, if there is a devil, he seems the boss. That's on page 8. But he had to work through that. By pomp, well, that's me thinking I'm too good to need God. And by worship of other things, those are my idols. Those are the things I would say, I won't be happy unless, and our idols could be unless, you know, our kids go to a certain college, unless our, for me, one for a long time was unless my kids go to church, unless my kids love me enough. You know, so people have, unless I get married, unless I have a baby. So all these things that we put ahead of God. So once that we get rid of those spiritual cataracts and we see how like trustworthy God is. And by this time, by step 2, I know I did, and the book tells us we start feeling power. Page 46 says, as soon as a man says he believes or is willing to believe, he begins to be infused with a new sense of power and direction, provided he takes other simple steps. So we get a little power, just enough to move on to the next step. And so we start saying, huh, like the food isn't calling me as much, and you know, life's a little better. And then we start trusting enough to surrender to God, to do a third step. And what that really means, I believe, is that it's me saying to God, take all of me. Here's a blank check with my life. I stop doing things for a result and start doing them just because I think it's what God would have me do. So that's the third step, surrender to God. Step four is where I inventoried my character defects, my resentments, my harms to others, my fears, my past relationships. And in step five, shared it with God and my sponsor. And the way I felt after that was like I had been given a new pair of glasses. It was like suddenly trees were greener. That's the only way I can explain it. Things were just different. And the book tells us that after step five, it says the feeling that the drink problem or the food problem has disappeared will often come strongly. So like there starts being real relief. I was ready to have God remove all these defects of character. So I made a list, asked him to remove them. And then I made my amends. And I did go back to that boy and confess everything. It did not go the way I wanted. I wanted it to go, "That's okay, Janet, I forgive you. And will you marry me?" It did not go that way. But God had other plans. And, you know, my happily ever after is downstairs watching college basketball right now. So it's okay. So I made my amends and then continued to live in 10, 11, and 12. So what does that mean? It means I look for when I've done something wrong and I ask God to forgive me and I fix it as best I can. I do that kind of on the spot. And then at night, some people call the nightly review a 10 step. Some people call it 11 step. I don't care. You know, it's like, I call it a 10 step. If anyone wants to go line by line in the big book and show me I'm wrong, you know, fine. I don't care. So I do a nightly review. I have a nightly review partner. We're the best of friends. I send her mine. She sends me hers. We go over stuff. We're dead honest with each other. So no secrets. I have a quiet time with God. Most mornings, you know, I'll confess every now and then I'm too tired or, you know, something, but I would say almost every day I put in close to an hour spending my time with God. And I tell my sponsees that right from day one, they're to spend 30 minutes with God. Because this whole program is about having a relationship with God. And if you want a relationship with someone, you have to spend time with them. So in my quiet time, I split it between prayer, meditation, and spiritual reading. I'll read the Bible, or I've looked up the devotionals that the founders of AA used, and I really love some of them, so I use them. And then step 12. Having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps. So I believe God has rewired my heart. Still some plumbing and electrical work to do, plenty of work to do, but there's been some rewiring. And so I've had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps. And I try to carry this message. So I work really hard at it. I sponsor a decent number of people. I speak a lot, you know, I'm fortunate enough that I get invited to speak. The great thing is that what you love doing is helpful to others and what God wants you to do. There's like nothing better than that in the world. My best friend and I put on a lot of workshops together and I try to practice these principles in all my affairs. My boss knows he could leave me with $1 million and I wouldn't touch it. I don't cheat on my taxes. I don't cheat on my husband. I try to practice these principles in all my affairs. So I guess I want to end by saying that I could do all this work that I've done. And I did a good deal of work and I still do. But if there were no God, it would come to nothing. It's like me being caught in a raging flood and the police are out with the bullhorns saying the helicopters can come and rescue you, get to the roof. And I climb, you know, up the stairs to the roof and the helicopter rescues me. Yes, I'm the one who climbed up the steps to the roof, but never let me be so arrogant as to think that I rescued myself. God sent Donna for me. God sent these 12 steps for me. God has had miracle after miracle in my life. He's performed for me. And for all those who work this program, it says in this book that the age of miracles is still with us. Miracles didn't end in biblical times, right? Bill Wilson said when he saw Abby, here sat a miracle directly across my kitchen table. And at its essence, I think that's what this program is about. It's about miracles and this great God who wants to launch search and rescue missions for all of us. And with that, I pass. Thanks.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you, Janet. That was just wonderful. Okay, I'm going to stop the recording now.